solve problems. Physical, spatial, theoretical, social. Her species has proved fertile ground for the virus's attentions. Cautiously, the male crosses beneath Bianca and springs up to her branch, safety line trailing in a white thread behind him. "Bridge across," she tells him when he is close enough to communicate with properly. "Quick now." The basic content of her speech is visual, in a rapid semaphore of the palps. A wealth of context, mostly her general dissatisfaction with him, is provided in the vibrations of her flurrying feet. He flashes his humble acquiescence briefly and heads out as far along the branch as he dares, settling and resettling his feet over and over as he considers the jump ahead. Portia flashes her exasperation back to Bianca, but her companion is watching something below. An apparition, like a walking carpet, is creeping along the forest floor. Another spider, but a species that the nanovirus has managed to gift with a greater size and little else. As bulky as half a dozen Portias, it would kill her in a moment, if only it could catch her. Bianca is hungry. She indicates the ground crawler and idly suggests they break their journey now. Portia considers and finds the suggestion has merit. She waits until the male has made his jump across, easily, despite all his trepidation, and leaves him hauling himself back along his own line to begin the bridge work. Then she flashes a message to Bianca, and the two of them begin to descend. The hairy hunter below is intent on its own hunger. The forest is not short of prey species of varying sizes, many of them abortive results of the nanovirus's work. There are some surviving vertebrate species, mice, birds, dwarf deer, snakes. But the virus has tried and failed with them. Kern's experiment called for monkeys, and she ensured that the green planets chosen would suffer no competition from close cousins. The vertebrates that the monkeys were intended to interact with were designed to reject the virus. They have changed hardly at all. Nobody considered the invertebrates, the complex ecosystem of tiny creeping things intended to be nothing more than a scaffolding by which the absent monkeys would ascend. In so many cases, as with the great tarantula descendant below that Portia is considering, whilst the virus was able to provoke growth, the sought-for neural complexity never arose. Often, the environmental pressure to select for such a facility was simply lacking. A sense of self and the ability to contemplate the universe are not necessarily survival traits in and of themselves. Portia is a rare exception, though not the only exception, where increased cognitive capacity granted an immediate and compelling advantage. The carpet-like hunter stops, the faintest of vibrations reaching it. The forest floor is strewn with its thread, forming a messy but effective sense organ that alerts it to the movements of its prey. Against a creature as simple as this, Portia and her kin prefer hunting methods that have not changed in thousands of years. Portia has discerned the pattern of threads below, running through the leaf litter, almost hidden, save to eyes as keen as hers. She reaches down with a foreleg and plays them carefully, speaking eloquently the language of touch and motion, creating a phantom prey and giving it the illusion of size, distance, and weight entirely conjured by her skill. She places herself in the primitive mind of the ground hunter, as surely as if she could actually implant her thoughts there. It advances a handful of steps, testing out this sensation, not wholly convinced. She wonders if it has had some near escapes with her kind before. The great shaggy abdomen is up, ready to shake out a cloud of barbed hairs that will choke Portia's book lungs and irritate her joints. She reaches down gingerly again, prying and tugging, suggesting that the illusory prey is getting further away, soon to escape entirely. Her body is mottled and irregular, as her ancestors were, and the ground hunter's simple eyes have not made her out. It takes the bait suddenly, in a hairy rush across the forest floor towards nothing, and Bianca drops on its back, fangs first, driving them in where its legs meet its body, and then springing away a few body lengths to be out of the way of any riposte. The hunter lunges after her, but stumbles, even as it does so, abruptly unsteady. Moments later, it is twitching and quivering as the venom takes effect, and the two females wait for it to grow motionless, though still alive, before closing in to feed. Bianca, in particular, remains taut for another leap to escape if need be. her abdomen heaving slightly in and out as she forces air past her book lungs. Up above, the male is looking down plaintively, and when Portia checks on him, he signals for permission to feed. She tells him to finish his work first. A moment later, he has dropped down practically on top of her, sending her leaping instinctively backwards, landing clumsily and flipping onto her back before righting herself angrily. Bianca has come within a whisker of killing the male, but he is stamping and signalling frantically. Danger coming! Danger! Spitters! And he is right. Here come her kind's ancestral foes. The spitting spiders, the Cytodes, have marched in step with Portia's kin all the way from their minuscule beginnings. They are somewhere between her and the groundhunter in size, but size was not the key to dominance even in the ancient days before the virus. Now she sees them creep warily forwards, a whole troop of them, eight individuals, spread out but watching, come down off their web to hunt. They hunt in packs, these uplifted spitters, and Portia has an understanding that they are not beasts, whilst not having achieved whatever she has become. They are the big, shambling killers, constantly on the edge of Portia's world, brutal, lurking primitives whose unseen, implicit presence keeps hatchlings from straying too far from the nest. If the numbers had been equal, then Portia and Bianca would have contested the kill, for they see that the spitters have been following the path of the same prey. Eight is too many, though, even with the additional tricks the three travellers can utilise. The Cytodes will throw out their sprays of sticky, venomous webbing. Although their eyesight is weak, and Portia and her kind are smart enough to anticipate and agile enough to dodge, the sheer number of nets will make the odds of their escaping poor. Conversely, the spitters are well aware of the danger that Portia's kind poses. The two species have clashed over untold generations, each time with more understanding of the enemy. Now, both recognise that the other is something less than kin, but something more than prey. Portia and Bianca make automatic threats, lifting their forelimbs and displaying their fangs. Portia is considering whether her secret new weapon would even the odds. Her mind plays out likely scenarios, with and without the male's assistance. The enemy numbers seem too great for her to be sure of victory, and her task comes first. In her mind is a meta-plan, just the sort of A to B route-finding that her distant antecedents performed, save that her goal is not just a spatial location, but an intangible victory condition. A fight now with the spitters would likely leave her in no position to achieve what she has set out to do. She signals to the other two to fall back, making her gestures large and slow enough that the inferior eyes of the spitters will read them. Can they understand her? She does not know. She could not even say whether they have some way of communicating amongst themselves that approximates to her own visual and vibrational language. Still, they hold off. No spitting, and only a minimal threat display from them, as Portia and her cohort retreat. Bianca's feet pluck out a muttering refrain of frustration and annoyance. Being larger than Portia, she is quicker to seek physical confrontation. She is here because that has its uses, but for that same reason she knows to follow Portia's lead. They ascend once more, aware now that they must hunt again, and hope that the Cytodes clan will be satisfied with what was left here for them. Sometimes the spitters follow, if they have the numbers, and then it would be a choice of fast flight or turn and ambush. By dark, they have brought down an orb web builder, and the male jumps on an unwary mouse, neither of which makes a hearty meal. Portia's active lifestyle and altered anatomy mean that she needs considerably more food than her predecessors, pound for pound. If they were to be forced to live by hunting alone, then their journey would take far longer than it should. Amongst her baggage, however, Bianca has a quartet of live aphids. She lets the little creatures out to suck sap, fending the male off in case he forgets that they're not for eating, or not yet. After dusk, when Portia has spun a makeshift tent in the canopy, complete with warning lines in all directions, the aphids produce glutinous honeydew, which the spiders can drink as though it was the nourishing liquidized innards of their prey. The domesticated creatures meekly return to Bianca's webbing afterwards, understanding only that they are safe with her, not realising that, in extremis, they themselves will become the meal. Portia is still hungry. Honeydew is subsistence stuff, nourishing without the satisfaction of taking real prey. It is difficult for her to crouch there, knowing that there are aphids and the male within reach. But she can look ahead and see that her long-term plan will suffer if those are consumed now. Her lineage has always specialised in looking ahead, and in looking beyond, too. Now she squats at the entrance to the makeshift tent forming their camp, Bianca and the male nestling beside her for warmth, and looks out through the gaps in the canopy at the lights populating the night sky. Her people know them, and see paths and patterns in them, and realise that they too move. Portia understands that their celestial journeys are predictable enough to use when navigating her own. One, though, is special. One light does not tread a slow and year-long course over the heavens, but hurries past, a genuine traveller, just as she is. Portia looks up now and sees that tiny glint of reflected light passing overhead, a solitary, motile speck in the vast dark, and she feels a kinship with it, lending to that orbiting pinpoint as much of an arachnomorphic personality as she can conceive of. Chapter 2.3 Enigma Variations. This time, they had all of Key Crew out of the morgue, Holston almost the last one to appear, stumbling on numb feet and shivering. He looked better than a lot of them, though. His little jaunt, mere moments of personal time, and over a century ago, had loosened him up. Most of the people he was now looking at had last opened their eyes while the Gilgamesh shared a solar system with the failing husk of Earth. They were crammed into the briefing room, all grey faces and shaven heads, some of them looking malnourished, others bloated. A few had pale mottling across their skins, some side effect of the sleep process that Holston couldn't guess at. He saw Guyon looking more alert than anyone else there, and guessed the mission commander had ordered himself to be woken early so that he could assert his bright, brisk dominance over this roomful of zombies. Holston checked off the departments. Command, engineering, science, and what looked like the whole of security, too. He tried to catch Lane's eye, but she barely glanced at him, nothing in her manner admitting to any century-ago liaison.
Right.
Guyon's sharp tone drew all ears as a final few stumbled in.
We're here. We've made it with 5% loss of cargo and around 3% system deterioration, according to the engineers. I consider that the greatest vindication of the human spirit and strength of will that history has ever known. You should all be proud of what we've achieved.
His tone was adversarial, certainly not congratulatory. And sure enough, he went on.
But the real work is yet to come. We have arrived, and as you all know, this was supposedly a system the old Empire Space Fleet frequented. We set our course for here because these were the closest extrasolar coordinates where we could hope to find a livable habitat and perhaps even salvageable tech. You all know the plan. We have their star maps, and there are other such locations within a relatively short journey of here. Just a short hop compared to the distances we've already travelled without mishap.
Always just 5% mishap, Holston thought, but did not say. Guyon's belief in the extent of the Imperial presence within this system was also highly speculative, from the classicist's own perspective. And even Old Empire was a maddeningly inaccurate term. Most of the others looked too groggy to really think beyond the words themselves, though. Again, he glanced at Lane, but she seemed to be focused only on the commander.
What most of you do not know is that the Gilgamesh intercepted transmissions emanating from this system on our way in, which have been identified as an automatic distress beacon. We have functioning technology.
He hurried on before anyone could get a question in.
The Gilgamesh has therefore plotted a flight path solution that will break us around the star. And on the way out, we'll come by slow enough for a meaningful pass close to the source of that signal. The planet there.
Now his audience started waking up, and there was a rising babble of questions that Guyon waved down.
That's right. A planet in the sweet spot. Just like we were promised. It's been thousands of years, but space doesn't care. It's there, and the old Empire has left a present for us too. And that could be good, or it could be bad. We're going to have to be careful. Just so you know, the signal isn't from the planet itself, but from some sort of satellite. Maybe just a beacon, maybe something more. We're going to try and open communications with it, but no guarantees.
And the planet?
Someone asked. Guyon indicated Rinas Vitas, the head of the scientific team.
We're loath to commit so far, the slender woman began, another who'd obviously been up for a while, or perhaps by nature unflappable. The analysis made by Gilgamesh on our way in suggests something only slightly smaller than Earth, at close to Earth's distance from the star, and with all the right components. Oxygen, carbon, water, minerals.
So why not commit? Why not say it?
Holston identified the speaker. Big Cast, who led the security detail. His chin and cheeks were raw, red and peeling horribly, and Holston remembered suddenly how the man had refused to lose his beard for the suspension chamber, and was now apparently paying the price. I remember him arguing with engineering over that, he thought. It should have seemed just days before, according to his personal waking history, but as he had noticed last time, there was clearly something imperfect about suspension. Certainly, Holston could not feel the centuries that had passed since they abandoned Earth, but something in his mind acknowledged that lost time, the sense of a yawning, terrible wasteland, a purgatory of the imagination. He found himself reluctant to consider ever going back under.
"Why, in all honesty?" Vitas replied brightly. "It's too good to be true. I want to overhaul our instruments. That planet is too Earth-like to be believed."
Looking around at all the suddenly sour faces, Holston raised his hand.
"But of course it's like Earth," he got out.
The looks turned on him were not encouraging, some merely creased with dislike, but rather more with exasperation. What's the bloody classicist want now? Desperate for some attention already?
"It's a terraforming project," he explained. "If it's like Earth, that just shows it's finished. Or near finished."
"There's no evidence the ancients ever actually practiced terraforming," Vitas told him, her tone an obvious put-down.
"Let me take you through the archives. It's mentioned 100 times in their writings."
But instead, Holston just shrugged, recognizing the showmanship of it all.
"There is," he told them. "Out there. We're heading straight towards it."
"Right,"
Guyon clapped his hands, perhaps annoyed that he had not been listening to his own voice for 2 minutes at a stretch.
"You each have your tasks, so go and make ready. Vitas, run checks on our instrumentation as you proposed. I want us to conduct a full inspection of the planet and satellite as we close. Lane, keep a close eye on ship's systems as we approach the star's gravity well. The Guild's not done anything but go in a straight line for a long time. Cast, get your people reacquainted with their kit, just in case we need you. Mason, you're working with my people on monitoring that signal. If there's anything active there to respond to us, I want to know about it."
Hours later, and Holston was almost the last person left in the communications suite, his dogged academic patience having outlasted most of Guyon's people. In his ear, the signal, full of static, still pulsed its single, simple message, clearer now than it had been out beyond the system, and yet saying no more. He had been sending responses regularly, seeking to spur something new, an elaborate academics game, where he formulated queries in formal Imperial C in the hope of seeming like the sort of caller that the beacon was crying out for. He started at a sudden movement beside him, as Lane slumped into the neighbouring seat.
"How's life in engineering?"
He took out the earpiece.
"Not supposed to be about people management," she grunted. "We're having to thaw out about 500 coffins from cargo to run repairs on them. Then we're having to tell 500 recently awoken colonists that they need to go right back into the freezer. Security have been called in. It's ugly. So, have you even worked out what it says yet? Who's in distress?"
Holston shook his head.
"It's not like that. Well, yes, it is. It says it's a distress beacon. It's calling for help. There are no specifics. It's a standard signal the old Empire used for that purpose, intended to be clear, urgent, and unmistakable, always assuming you're even a member of the culture that produced it. I only know what it is because our early spacefarers were able to reactivate some of the stuff they found in Earth orbit and extrapolate function from context. So, say hi to it. Let it know we've heard it."
He sucked in the breath of the annoyed academic, starting off with the same pedantic, "It's not..." before her frown made him reconsider.
"It's an automated system. It's waiting for a response it recognizes. It's not like those extrasolar listening post things we used to have, searching for any kind of signal pattern at all. And even those, I was never convinced by them, by the idea that we could necessarily recognize an alien transmission for what it was. That's too rooted in our assumption that aliens will be in any way like us. It's
You understand the concept of cultural specificity. Don't lecture me, old man. It's... Will you stop with that? I'm, what, 7 years older than you? 8? You're still the oldest man in the universe. Hearing that, he was very aware that he honestly did not know how the pair of them stood, one to another. So maybe I was just the last man in the universe. Right then. Or me and Guyan, at least. Apparently it doesn't matter now, anyway.
Yeah, well, you've been up for how long? Before they woke you.
He goaded her.
Keep pulling those long hours and you'll catch up real soon, won't you?
She had no ready comeback, and when he glanced at her, her face was long and pensive.
This is no way to run a civilization, he thought. But of course, that's not what we are. Not anymore. We're a civilization in transport, waiting to happen somewhere else. Maybe here. We're the last cutting of old Earth.
The pause stretched out between them, and he found he had no way of breaking its hold, until Lane abruptly shook herself and said,
"So, cultural specificity. Let's talk about that."
He was profoundly grateful for the lifeline.
"So, I know it's a distress beacon, but that is literally only because we've had prior contact with Imperial tech, and in sufficient context that we can make assumptions. Some of which may be wrong, even. And this isn't an alien species, this is us, our ancestors. And in turn, they won't recognize our signals, necessarily. There's this myth that advanced cultures will be so expansively cosmopolitan that they'll be able to effortlessly talk down to the little people, right? But the Empire never intended its tech to be forward compatible with primitives, meaning us. Why would it? Like everyone else, they only ever intended to talk to each other. So I'm telling this thing, hello, here we are, but I don't know what protocols and what codes their system is expecting to receive from whatever rescuer would have been planned for, however many thousand years ago. They can't even hear us. We're just background static to them." She shrugged. "So what? We get there and send Cast over with a cutting torch and open her up?"
He stared at her. "You forget how many people died in the early space years trying to get at Empire tech. Even with all the systems fried by their old electromagnetic pulse weapons, there were still plenty of ways for it to kill you." Another lift of the shoulders, indicating a tired woman at the edge of her reserves. "Maybe you forget how much I don't like Cast." Did I forget? Did I ever know that? He had a vertiginous sense that maybe he had, but that any such knowledge had fallen unnoticed from his head during the long, cold age of his suspension. And it genuinely had been an age. There had been whole, discrete periods of human history that had not lasted so long. He found himself holding on to the console as though at any moment the illusion of gravity gifted by the Gilgamesh's deceleration would vanish, and he would simply slip away in some random direction, with all connection lost. These are all the people there are. With the image of that roomful of near strangers he had never had a chance to get to know before they sealed him in the coffin. This is life and society and human contact, now and forever. It seemed to be Lane's turn to find the silence awkward. But she was a practical woman. She simply got up to go, drawing away sharply as he tried to put a hand on her arm. "Wait." It came out more as a plea than he had intended. "You're here, and I need your help."
"On what?"
"Help me with the signal. The beacon signal. There's always been a lot of interference, but I think it's possible that there's actually a second signal clashing with it on a close frequency. Look." He passed a handful of analyses over to her screen. "Can you clean it up? Compensate it out if it's noise, or at least something? I'm running out of things to try right now." She seemed relieved at actually getting a sensible request from him, and resumed her seat. For the next hour, the two of them worked wordlessly side by side, she with what was now her task, and he in sending increasingly desperate inquiries aimed at the satellite, none of which evinced any response. Eventually, he felt that he might as well just be sending over gibberish, for all the difference it made. Then, "Mason?" from Lane, and there was something new in her tone. "Hmm? You're right. It is another signal." A pause. "But we're not getting it from the satellite." He waited, seeing her fingers move over the panels, checking and rechecking. "It's from the planet."
"Shit, you're serious?"
And then, with a hand to his mouth, "Oh, sorry, I'm sorry, not language befitting the dignity of etc., but,
No. This is definitely a shit-worthy moment."
"It's a distress call? It's repeated?"
It's not like your distress signal. Much more complex. It must be actual live talk. It's not repeating. For a moment, Holston actually felt her hope peak, pulling the air between them taut with the untold potential of the future. And then she hissed. Bollocks. What? No, it is repeating. It's longer and more complicated than your distress call, but this is the same sequence again. Hands on the move once more. And it's... we're... her bony shoulders sagged. It's... I think it's bounce. Come again? I think this other signal is bouncing from the planet. Well, most likely hypothesis. The satellite is sending a signal to the planet, and we're catching bounce back. Fuck, I'm sorry. I really thought... Lane, are you sure? She cocked an eyebrow at him, because he was not joining in her dejection. What? The satellite is communicating with the planet, he prompted. It's not just a bounce back of the distress call. It's something longer. A different message sent to the planet than for the rest of the universe. But it's just on a loop. Same as... She slowed down. You think there's someone down there? Who knows? But they're not broadcasting. Who knows? It's a terraform world. Whatever Vetus says, it was created to be lived on. And even if the satellite is nothing but a call for help these days, if they seeded the world with people... So maybe they really are savages. Maybe they don't have the tech to receive or transmit, but they could still be there. On a world specifically made for humans to live on. She stood up suddenly. I'm off to fetch Guyan. For a moment he looked at her, thinking. Seriously? That was the first thing you thought of? But he nodded resignedly, and she was off, leaving him to listen in on the newfound contact between satellite and planet, and try to work out what it signified. To his great surprise, it took him very little time to do so.
It's what?
Guyan demanded. The news had brought along not just the commander, but most of the key crew as well. A series of mathematics problems, Holston explained to them all. The only reason it took me as long as it did was that I was expecting something more sophisticated. Something informative, like the beacon. But it's maths. Weird maths, too, Lane commented, looking over his transcription. The sequences get quite complicated, but they're set out step by step from first principles, basic sequences. She was frowning. It's like, Mason, you mentioned extrasolar listening posts before? It's a test, yes, Holston agreed. An intelligence test.
But you said it was pointed at the planet,
Cost stated. Which raises all kinds of questions. Yes, Holston shrugged. I mean, this is very old technology. This is the oldest working tech that anyone anywhere ever discovered. So what we're seeing could just be the result of a breakdown, an error. But yes, makes you think.
Or not,
Lane put in dryly. When the others just stared at her, she continued in her snide tone.
Come on, people. Am I the only one thinking it? Come on, Mason, you've been trying to get the thing to notice you for how long now? We've rounded the star on our approach to the planet, and you're still drawing blanks. So now you're saying it's setting some sort of maths test for the planet?
Yes, but...
So send in the answers,
she suggested. Holston stared at her for a long time, then glanced sideways at Guyan.
Well, we don't know what... Do it,
Guyan ordered. Carefully, Holston called up the answers he had compiled, the early problems solved easily on his fingers, the later ones only with artificial help. He had been sending plaintive signals to the distant satellite for hours. It was simple enough to dispatch the string of numbers instead. They waited, all of the key crew. It took 7 minutes and some seconds for the message to reach its intended destination. There was some shuffling. Cast cracked his knuckles. One of the science team coughed. A little over 14 minutes after sending, the distress beacon ceased. Chapter 2.4 Poor Relations. Horsha's people are natural explorers. As active carnivores, with a considerably more demanding metabolism than their forebears, too many of them in one place will quickly overhunt any home territory. Traditionally, their family units fragment often. The females who are weakest, with the fewest allies, are the ones who venture further afield to establish new nests.
Such diasporas happen regularly, for, although they lay far fewer eggs than their ancestors, and although their standards of care are far below human, so that infant mortality rates remain high, the species population is in colossal expansion. They are spreading across their world, one broken family at a time. Portia's own expedition is something different, though. She is not seeking a nesting ground, and there is a home that her present plans require her to return to. In her mind and her speech, it is the Great Nest by the Western Ocean, and several hundred of her kind, most but not all relatives of one degree or another, reside there. The basic domestication of the aphids and their husbandry by the spiders has allowed the Great Nest to grow to unprecedented size without the shortages that would prompt migration or expulsion. Over several generations, the social structure of the Great Nest has grown exponentially more complex. Contact has been made with other nests, each of which has its own way of feeding the modest multitudes. There has been some halting trade, sometimes for food, but more often for knowledge. Portia's people are ever curious about the further reaches of their world. That is why Portia is travelling now, following the paths of stories and rumours and third-hand accounts. She has been sent. The three of them are already entering claimed territory. The signs are unmistakable, not merely regularly maintained web bridges and lines amid the trees, but patterns and designs stating by sight and scent that these hunting grounds are spoken for. This is exactly what Portia has been looking for. Ascending as high as they can go, the travellers can see that, to the north, the character of the formerly endless forest changes dramatically. The great canopy thins, fading away in patches to reveal startling stretches of cleared ground. Beyond that, there are still trees, but they are of a different species and regularly spaced, in a manner that looks jarringly artificial to their eyes. This is what they have come to see. They could simply avoid this little piece of family turf that they have come across and go look. Portia's plan, however, the step-by-step route that she has plotted from the start of their trek to its successful conclusion, specifically calls for her to gather information. For her ancestors, this would mean painstaking visual reconnaissance. For her, it means asking questions of the locals. They proceed with caution and openly. There is a real possibility that the incumbents may chase them off. However, Portia can mentally put herself in their place. Consider how she herself would look upon an intruder. She can think through the permutations enough to know that an aggressive or covert entrance will increase the chance of a hostile reception. Sure enough, the locals are sharp enough to spot the newcomers quickly, and curious enough to make their presence known at a distance, signalling for Portia and her fellows to approach. There are seven of them, five females and two males, and they have a neat nest strung between two trees, liberally surrounded with trip lines to warn them of any overbold visitors. Also present are a brood of at least two dozen spiderlings of various ages, hatched from a communal creche. Fresh from the egg, they're able to crawl and take live prey, and understand a variety of tasks and concepts without having to be taught. Probably no more than three or four of them will reach adulthood. Portia's people lack a mammal's helpless infant stage and the maternal bond that accompanies it. Those that do survive will be the strongest, the most intelligent, and the best able to interact with others of their kind. The palp semaphore language allows for communication over a mile away in clear conditions, but is not suitable for complex discussions. The more subtle, step vibration speech will not travel far across the ground or down a branch. In order to hold a free and frank exchange of views, one of the local females spins a web that stretches between several trees, large enough for everyone to rest a few feet on its many anchor points and follow the conversation as it progresses. One of the locals climbs onto the web, and at her invitation, Portia joins her. "We bring you greetings from the Great Nest on the Western Ocean," Portia begins, meaning, "We are but three, but we have friends. We have travelled far and seen many things," for information is often a trade good in itself. The locals remain suspicious. They are spoken for by their largest female, who shudders upon the web and shifts her feet, saying, "What is your purpose? This is no place for you." "We do not seek to hunt," Portia states. "We do not come to settle. We shall soon return to the Great Nest. Word has come to us." Concept is expressed very clearly to their minds, vibrations twanging down a taut line. They are naturally equipped to think in terms of information transmitted at a distance. The land beyond your land is of interest. Unrest amongst the locals.
It is not to be travelled, their leader says.
If that is so, then that is what we have come to discover. Will you tell us what you know? More disquiet, and Portia is aware that her mental map of what is going on must have a hole somewhere, because they are reacting in a way she cannot account for. Their leader wishes to appear bold, however.
Why should we?
We will tell you things in return. Or we have understanding to exchange. For the spiders, mere telling and understanding are two distinctly different currencies. The locals step back off the web at a signal from their leader and huddle close, keeping several eyes on the newcomers. There is a shuffling huddle of speech, softly stepped out so that it does not reach their visitors. Portia retreats as well, and her two companions join her. Bianca has no particular ideas, save that she is anticipating having to go up against the lead female, who is noticeably bigger. The male, though, surprises Portia.
They're afraid, he suggests. Whatever is ahead of us, they are afraid that we may stir it up, and it will attack them.
It is natural for a male to think about fear, Portia decides. That she agrees with him makes finding out the truth about their destination all the more important. At last, the locals return to the web, and negotiations resume.
Show us your understanding, their leader challenges.
Portia signals to Bianca, who unwraps one of the docile aphids from alongside her abdomen and displays it to the skittish surprise of the locals. The little beast is milked for honeydew, and Portia wraps up a sagging parcel of the sweet stuff and deposits it in the centre of the web where the locals approach it. Once they have tasted it, and once they understand Portia's mastery over the animals, they are more than ready to make some manner of deal. The value of an independent food source is immediately evident to them, especially given their mysterious northern neighbours, who might soon threaten their hunting grounds.
What of these will you trade?
The local leader asks, eagerness evident in her movements. We have two of these beasts for those that give us a full account of what lies beyond your lands, Portia offers, knowing that this is not what the locals really wish to trade for. Also, we have eggs, but the raising and care of these creatures requires skill, or they will die young, and you will have nothing. There is now an urgent channel of talk running between the lead female and the others, and Portia catches fragments of it along the web. They are too agitated to be careful.
You said you could trade, the big female demands.
Yes, we can trade this understanding, but we will ask for more in return. Portia is not referring to teaching, but to something deeper. One of the secrets of her species' continuing success. The nanovirus itself is subject to variations in its transcription. It was designed that way in order to creatively accomplish its hardwired aim, to bring the host to a detected level of sophistication set by its creators, and once its victory conditions are met, to cease further assistance. Its creators included such safeguards so as to prevent their protégés continuing to develop into superhuman monkey gods. The virus was intended for a primate host, however, and so the end state that it has been programmed to seek is something that Portia Labiata can never become. Instead, the nanovirus has mutated and mutated in its inbuilt quest to reach an impossible goal, the end that justifies all conceivable means. More successful variants lead to more successful hosts, who in turn pass on the superior mutated infection. From the microscopic point of view of the nanovirus, Portia and every other affected species on the planet are merely vectors for the onward transmission of the virus's own evolving genes. Long ago in Portia's evolutionary history, her species' social development was greatly accelerated by a series of mutations in the reigning infection. The virus began to transcribe learned behaviour into the genome of sperm and egg, transforming acquired memes into genetically inheritable behaviour. The economic, force-evolved brains of Portia's kind share more structural logic with each other than chance-derived human minds do. Mental pathways can be transcribed, reduced to genetic information, unpacked in the offspring and written as instinctive understanding, sometimes concrete skills and muscle memory, but more often whole tranches of knowledge, ragged-edged with loss of context, that the newborn will slowly come to terms with throughout its early life. The process was piecemeal at first, imperfect, sometimes fatal, but more reliable with each generation as the more efficient strains of virus prospered. Portia has learned a great deal in her life, but some things she was either born with or came to her as she developed. Just as all new-hatched spiderlings can hunt and creep and jump and spin, so Portia's early moultings brought with them an innate understanding of language and access to fragments of her forebears' lives. That is now ancient history, a facility that Portia's people have possessed from back before their histories began. More recently, however, they have learned to exploit the nanovirus's enhanced capabilities, just as the virus in turn is exploiting them. "He has the understanding," Portia confirms, a flick of one palp indicating her male follower. "But we will trade like for like. You have understanding of how to live here, and the precautions you take. That is what we seek." The next moment, she realizes that she has overplayed her hand, because the big female goes very still on the web, a particular hunting stillness that signals raw aggression. "So your great nest will come to our lands after all. You are not here to hunt, and yet tomorrow your kin intend to hunt here." Because such traded understanding would not benefit Portia herself, but only generations to come, those whose genomes are as yet unwritten. "We seek understanding of all places," Portia protests, but the language of motion and vibration is a hard one to dissemble in. Enough unintended body language leaks into it to confirm the suspicions of the big female. Abruptly, the local leader has reared up, two pairs of legs raised high and her fangs exposed. It is a brute language unchanged for millions of years. "See how strong I am." Her rear legs are bunched, ready to spring. "Reconsider." "Back off," Portia warns her. She herself is tensed up, but she is not showing submission, nor retreating, nor measuring her legs against the others.
"Go now, or fight,"
the angry female demands. Portia notes that she does not necessarily have the wholehearted support of her fellows, who are anxiously flagging up concern or sending cautioning words along the strands of the web. Portia creeps sideways and feels a new dancing from behind her, a charging advance from Bianca that also serves as a kind of battle hymn. The local leader is obviously thrown by the fact that her opponent's speaker is not also their fighter, and she backs off a little, warily. Moreover, Bianca has armour. There is a functional limit to how much understanding any individual can inherit from the virus. New information rewrites the old, though perhaps each generation's ability to store such innate knowledge is a little greater than the last. This band of backwoods locals will have a handful of tricks all their own, carefully preserved down the years. Their individuals can learn and teach, but their inbuilt knowledge base is limited. A larger community like Great Nest has a great many understandings to draw upon. Different lineages passing on their mysteries and trading with others. Different discoveries, tricks and knacks can be combined and experimented with. Great Nest is more than the sum of its parts. Bianca is no artisan, not by learning nor by inherent understanding, but she wears the fruits of others' labours. Curved wooden shields she has glued to her palps, dyed in aggressive, clashing colours. She rears high, measuring legs against the big female, but then hunches down, her shields raised. They fight in the manner of their kind. They display, threaten, bare their fangs. They dance across the web, each step sounding like a goading word. The local female is larger, and she knows how this goes. Her greater size will convince the smaller intruder to back down, because otherwise the newcomer will die. Portia's kin share something with tool-using man. They are very able to harm each other. They were spider killers from the first, and their venom will immobilize an enemy of their own species as easily as it would a spitter. If matters come to that, usually the victor will give in to instinct and feed. For this reason, they have a culture that shies away from actual violence because of the risks inherent in any clash. The danger they pose to one another has been a great civilizing influence, just as much as has that sense of kinship their shared viral heritage gifted them with. But Bianca is not backing down, however clearly her opponent outmatches her. The threat displays become more and more aggressive, the big female leaping and darting about the web, whilst Bianca sidles sideways and keeps her shields up against the eventual pouncing strike that must be coming. Portia, for her part, spins her thread and readies herself to use another Great Nest innovation. This one new enough that she has had to learn it, though perhaps she may be able to virally gift it to her offspring. The big female springs just as Portia is ready. Bianca takes the fang strike on her shields, the impact knocking her over onto her back. The female rears up for another strike, infuriated. The stone that strikes her knocks her clean off the web, tumbling down to hang by her safety line, twitching and convulsing. Her abdomen is cracked open on one side where the missile tore through, and the loss of fluid to her body is already causing her remaining limbs to curl in upon themselves involuntarily. Portia has already reloaded, the slingshot of silk strung in a taut V between her wide-placed front feet and her powerful hind legs. The locals stare at her. A couple have crept part way towards their injured leader, but Bianca is ahead of them, dropping to drive her fangs into her victim's cracked carapace. Portia assesses the locals. They have adopted a submissive posture, thoroughly cowed. One of the other females, not the largest, but perhaps the boldest, steps deferentially onto the web. "What do you want?" she dances out. "Good. Let us trade," Portia states, as Bianca rejoins her. "Tell us about your neighbours." After they are done, each side weighing what it is willing to share against the relative bargaining power of the other party, Portia's male scuttles onto the web and distills his understanding of aphid husbandry into a neatly silk-wrapped packet of sperm. One of the local males performs a similar service with his own day-to-day knowledge of his family's territory and its aggressive neighbours. This active use of the viral transcription is not behaviour prompted by the virus itself, but a cultural tradition amongst Portia's people. Information as currency, by means of a transfer that incidentally assists the virus in propagating its genetic code. At the same time, the next generation of spiderlings will share kinship. A bridge between Portia's great nest and this little family, part of a great web of such interrelations whose connections can be traced, community to community, across much of the planet. What the locals now say about the North is alarming, a potential threat that Portia's great nest seems likely to encounter quite soon. At the same time, it is intriguing, and Portia decides that the plan requires a closer personal look. Chapter 2.5 All These Worlds Are Yours. The reply that came back from the satellite was not intentionally encoded, but Holston still sweated over what seemed to him an age, trying to turn the radio signal into something comprehensible. In the end, it gave up its secrets under the combined might of Lane, the Gilgamesh, and himself, presenting him with a curt, brief message in classical Imperial C that he could at least make a stab at translating. Finally, he leant back in his seat, aware that all eyes were fixed on him. "It's a warning," he told them. "It's saying that we're transmitting from incorrect coordinates, or something like that. It says we're forbidden here."
"It looks as though it's warming up,"
observed one of the science team, who had been taking readings from the distant object.
"I see a swift increase in energy usage. Its reactor is increasing output."
"It's awake, then,"
Guyon declared, somewhat vacuously, in Holston's opinion.
"I reckon it's still just automatic signals," Lane guessed. "Tell it we're responding to its distress call."
Holston had already phrased a reply in scholar's language, which read as formally as an academy exercise, then had Lane and the Gilgamesh transcribe the message into the same electronic format the satellite was using. The waiting, as the signals danced across those millions of kilometres of void, was soon stretching everybody's nerves.
"It's calling itself the Second Bryn Sentry Habitat,"
Holston translated eventually. It's basically telling us to alter our course to avoid the planet. Before Guyan could ask, he added, and it's not mentioning the distress call now. I think, because we've gone in with an answer to whatever it was signalling to the planet, it's that system we're interacting with.
Well, tell it who we are, and tell them we're coming to help them,
Guyan instructed him.
Seriously, I'm not sure.
Just do it, Mason.
Why would it be signalling elementary maths
to the planet? Vetus complained to nobody in particular.
I can see all sorts of systems coming online, I think, added her underling at the sensor suite. This is incredible. I've never seen anything like it.
I'm launching some drones, both for the Sat and for the planet, Karst announced.
Agreed, said Guyan.
It doesn't recognize us, Holston reported, frantically translating the latest message from the satellite, stumbling over its antique grammar. It says we're not authorized here. It says something about biological hazard.
And at the shudder that went through the crew.
No, wait. It's calling us an unauthorized biohazard. I think it's threatening us.
How big is this thing again?
Karst demanded.
A little under 20 meters on its longest axis, was the reply from the science team.
Well then, bring it on.
Karst, this is old Empire tech, Holston snapped.
We'll see what that's worth when the drones get there.
As the Gilgamesh was still fighting to slow down, the drones outstripped it rapidly, their own thrust hurrying them towards the planet and its lone sentinel at an acceleration that a manned craft could not have managed without pulping its occupants.
I have another warning to divert, Holston reported.
Look, I think we're in the same position as with the distress call. Whatever we're sending it just isn't being recognized by the system. Probably if we were supposed to be here, we'd have the right codes or something.
You're the classicist, so work them out, Guyan snapped.
It's not like that. It's not like the old Empire had a single, what, password or something.
We have archives of Imperial transmissions, don't we? So just strip some protocols from those.
Holston sent a glance of mute appeal towards Lane, but she was avoiding his gaze. Without entertaining any hope whatsoever, he began paring ID and greetings codes from those fragments of old Empire recordings that had survived, and throwing them at random towards the satellite.
I've got signal from the drones on screen, Karst reported,
and a moment later they were looking at the planet itself. It was still just a glint, barely distinct from the surrounding starfield, even with the best magnification of the drone's electronic eyes, but they could see it growing. A minute later, and Vitas pointed out the tiny pinprick shadow of its moon passing across the planet's surface.
Where's the satellite? Guyan demanded.
Not that you'd see it at this distance, but it's coming round from the far side, using the planet's atmosphere and the moon to bounce its signal to us.
Drone party's splitting off now, Karst reported. Let's take a proper look at this Bryn thing.
More warnings. Nothing's getting through to it, Holston slipped in, aware that by now nobody was really listening to him.
Karst, remember no damage to the satellite once you contact, Guyan was saying. Whatever tech's there, we want it in one piece. No problems. And there she is. Starting our run right now. Karst!
Relax, Commander. They know what they're doing.
Holston glanced up to see the drones fixing their aim at a point on the growing green orb's circumference.
Look at their colour, Vitas breathed.
Unhealthy,
Lane agreed.
No, that's old Earth colour.
Green.
This is it, one of the engineers whispered. We're here. We made it.
Visual on the satellite,
Karst announced, highlighting a tiny glint on the screen.
This is the second Bryn Sentry habitat, Holston read out insistently. This planet is claimed by
the what?
Something. Exaltation program, and any interference is forbidden.
Exaltation what?
Lane asked sharply.
I don't know. Holston was racking his brains for references, hunting through the ship's archives. There was something about the old Empire fell because it descended into sinful ways. You know the myth cycle?
A few grunts of confirmation.
The exaltation of beasts, that was one of the sins of the ancients.
Karst let out a yelp of surprise, and moments later, the transmissions from his satellite-bound drones exploded into static.
Oh, shit! Everything heading for the satellite just died, he bellowed.
Lane, Guyan started.
Already on it. Last moments of... A busy silence as she worked.
Here, this is the last one to go, by about a second. There,
brief power surges, and the other drones are gone. Then this one goes right after. It just blew your drones, Cast.
What with? Why would it need a...
Look, that thing could be serious military hardware for all we know, Lane snapped.
Or it would need to be ready to track and deal with deep space object impact, suggested Vitas. Anti-asteroid lasers, maybe.
Lane was frowning at the readouts. I'm not sure it did shoot. Cast, how open are the drone systems? The security chief swore.
We are still heading towards it, Holston pointed out. Even as he said this, some of the other drone screens were dying. The machines Cast had been sending planet-side. The satellite was snuffing them out the moment it rounded the world enough to obtain line of sight.
What the fuck's going on?
Cast demanded, fighting for control, sending his last pair of machines zigzagging towards the planet. A moment later, there was a sudden energy spike, a colossal expenditure of power from the satellite, and one of the two surviving machines was gone.
Now that was a shot, Lane confirmed grimly. That atomized the bastard.
Cast swore foully as he coded instructions for the last machine, sending it spiralling towards the planet, trying to keep the curve of the horizon between the drone and the satellite.
Are those weapons a danger to the Gilgamesh?
Guyan asked, and the room fell silent.
Probably, yes.
Vitas sounded unnaturally calm.
However, given how much energy we've just seen, its ability to use them may be limited.
It won't need a second shot at us, Lane said grimly. We're not going to be able to deviate from this course, not significantly. We're already decelerating as much as is safe. We have too much momentum. We're plotted to come into orbit.
It's telling us to leave or it will destroy us, Holston said tonelessly. As the Gilgamesh's computers adapted, they became quicker at bringing him a comprehensible record of the signal, and he found that he was now reading the reproduction of an ancient script almost fluently. Even before any demands from Guyan, he was already phrasing his reply. Travelers in distress. Do not initiate hostile action. Civilian transport ship requires assistance. Lane was looking over his shoulder critically as he sent it.
It is adjusting its positioning,
from the science team.
Pointing at us,
Guyan concluded.
It's an inexact comparison, but...
But yes, in the minds of everyone there.
Holston could feel his heart hammering madly.
Travelers in distress, do not initiate hostile action. Civilian transport ship requires assistance. But the message wasn't getting through. Guyan opened his mouth to issue some desperate order, but Lane burst out,
Send it back its own distress call, for fuck's sake!
Holston goggled at her for a moment, then let out a cry of some nameless emotion, triumph inextricably mixed with annoyance at not having thought of it himself. Moments later, it was done. There were some hard minutes then, waiting to see how the satellite would react, to see if they had been in time. Even as Holston returned the satellite's own distress signal to it, the attack could already have been sent leaping across space towards them, fast enough that they would not even know until it struck. Finally, Holston sagged back in his seat with relief. The others were crowding round, staring at his screen, but none of them had the classical education to translate it until he put them out of their suspense. Please hold for further communication, he told them, or something like that. I hope, it's gone to wake up something more sophisticated. There was a murmur of conversation behind him, but he was counting the minutes until the next transmission arrived. When the screen filled instantly with code, he was elated for a fraction of a second before letting out a hiss of exasperation.
It's gibberish. It's just a wall of nonsense. Why is it...
Wait, Lane interrupted him. It's a different sort of signal, that's all. Gilgamesh has matched the encoding with some stuff in your archives, old man. It's audio. It's speech.
Everyone was silent once more. Holston glanced around at a cramped room full of bald men and women, all looking in less than good health, still shivering from the after effects of their unthinkably long suspension, and all unable to keep up with the revelations and emotional trauma of their current situation.
I'm honestly not sure who's even still following this.
Probably it's still an automated...
He started, but tailed off. Not sure if he even had the energy for the argument.
Right. Gilgamesh has done his best to decode, based on the fragments in archive, Lane reported. Everyone want to hear this?
Yes,
Guyan decided. What came to them from the ship's speakers was hideous. a corroded, static-spiked mess in which a female voice could just be discerned. Nothing but isolated words breaking in and out of the interference. Words in a language that nobody but Holston could comprehend. Holston had been watching the commander's face, because it had been obvious to him what they would get, and he saw a spasm of rage spike there briefly before being fought down. Oh, that's not good.
Mason, translate.
Give me time. And if you can clean it up any, Lane.
Already on it, she muttered.
Behind them, the others began speculating cautiously. What had been speaking? Was it merely an automatic message, or... Vetus was speculating on the old Empire's supposed intelligent machines. Not just a sophisticated autonomous engine like the Gilgamesh, but devices that could think and interact as if they were human. Or more than human. Holston hunched over his console, phones to his ears, listening to the incrementally clearer versions that Lane was scrubbing for him. At first, he couldn't understand more than a few words, having to slow the transmission down and focus on small slices of it, while trying to wrestle with a thoroughly unexpected intonation and pattern of speech. There was a lot of interference, too, a weird, irregular rise and fall of static that kept interfering with the actual message.
"I've got the drone into the atmosphere,"
Karst announced abruptly. Everyone had almost forgotten him, as he sent instructions to his one surviving remote, with no idea of whether each refinement to its course would arrive in time to prevent its destruction. When he had the attention of the majority, he added,
"Who wants to see our new home?"
The drone's images were grainy and distorted. A high-altitude scan of a world so green that one of the scientists asked if the picture had been recolored.
"You're seeing exactly what the drone's seeing," Karst assured them.
"It's beautiful," someone put in. Most others simply stared. It was beyond their experience and their imagination. The Earth that they remembered had not looked like this. Any such verdant explosion had been locked away in the years before the ice, and it never returned after the toxic thaw. They came from a planet immeasurably poorer than this one.
"All right."
The conversation behind Holston had grown into a hubbub of speculation, then died away into ennui in the time it had taken him to adjust to the new transmission.
"Translation here."
He sent it to their screens. "The second Bryn Sentry Habitation acknowledges your request for assistance. You are currently on a heading that will bring you to a quarantine planet, and no interference with this planet will be countenanced. Please provide full details of your emergency situation so that habitat systems may analyze and advise. Any interference with Kern's world will be met with immediate retaliation. You are not to make contact with this planet in any way."
"We'll see about that," Karst declared, and... "Doesn't know about the last drone, then? I've said it's so as to try and keep on the far side of the planet from that thing."
Mason was still playing back the message, trying to work out what that continuing interference was. Like the distress call, it sounded as though there was some other message hitching a ride along with the satellite's signal. "Is it still sending down to the planet?" he asked Lane.
"It is, but I've compensated for that. You shouldn't be getting..." "Kern's world?" Vitas noted. "Is that a name?"
"Kern and Bryn are phonetic," Holston admitted. "If they're words, they're not in my vocabulary files."
"What response?"
"Will it understand if we speak to it?" Guyan pressed.
"I'll send an encoded message like before," Holston told him.
Whatever it is, it's not speaking Imperial C the way the textbooks think it should be spoken. Different accent, different culture, maybe. I don't think I could speak to it well enough to be properly understood."
"Send this."
Guyan shunted over a block of text for Holston to translate and encode.
"We are the Ark ship Gilgamesh, carrying 500,000 humans in suspension. It is of utmost priority that we are able to establish a presence on your planet. This is a matter of the survival of the human species. We require your assistance in preserving our cargo."
"It's not going to work." Holston wondered whether Guyan had somehow heard some other message from the satellite, because that wasn't an appropriate response as far as he was concerned. He sent it off, though, and returned to listening to the previous transmission, recruiting Lane to try and pass out the rider signal, to separate out something comprehensible. And then, abruptly, he began to hear it, listening between the words, stock still and gripping his console, as the meaning came through to him. "The second Bryn Sentry Habitation acknowledges your request for assistance. You are currently on a heading that will bring you to a quarantine planet, and no interference with this planet will be countenanced. Please provide full details of your emergency situation so that Habitat Systems may analyze and advise. Any interference with Kern's world will be met with immediate retaliation. You are not to make contact with this planet in any way.
Cold, so very long waiting. Why won't they come? What has happened? Can they all really have gone? Is there nobody, nothing left at all of home? So very cold. Coffin cold. Nothing is working, nothing left. Eliza, why won't you answer me? Speak to me. Put me out of my misery. Tell me they're coming. Tell me they're going to come and take me, wake me, warm me from this cold. So cold.
Mason had kicked his seat back from his position. But the voice still droned and grated in his earphones, absolutely the same voice as the main message's formal efficiency, but twisted by a terrible despair.
"We may have a problem."
"New transmission coming through," from Lane, even whilst others were demanding to know what Holston meant.
"What should I do with the drone?" Cast put in.
"Just sit on it for now. Tell it to keep itself blocked from communications with the habitat," Guyon told him. "Mason?"
But Holston was already working through the new transmission. It was a far shorter, punchier message than the first, but the word stuck in his mind. Habitat. That was my translation. Did the ancients mean that? They couldn't really have meant something for someone to live in. 20 meters across for however many millennia? No, that can't possibly...
It says, "Do we want to speak to Eliza?"
he choked out. Inevitably, someone had to ask, "Who's Eliza?" as though anybody there could have answered the question.
"We do,"
Guyen decided, which was just as well as Holston had already sent the response. Minutes later, the delay shorter each time as they neared the planet, something new spoke to them. Holston recognised the same voice as before, though considerably clearer, and still with that horrible stream of consciousness backing, constantly trying to break through. His translation for the others came swiftly. By now, he reckoned he must be as fluent in Imperial Sea as anyone had ever been in post-glacial history. He passed it around the others' screens.
"Good evening, travellers. I am Eliza Kearns, composite expert system of the 2nd Bryn Sentry Habitat. I'm sorry, but I may have missed the import of some communications that you have already sent to me. Would you please summarise what was said?"
There was an interesting split in the listeners then. Command and security remained mostly unmoved, whilst science and engineering were thrown into sudden debate. What did the voice mean by expert system? Was Holston sure that was the proper translation? Was it actually an intelligent machine? Or just something pretending to be one? Holston himself was busy piecing together that background message, although he felt less and less happy about it. The words, the very tone of horror and desperation in his ears, were making him feel ill.
"Good evening, travellers. I am Eliza Kearns, composite expert system of the 2nd Bryn Sentry Habitat. I'm sorry, I may have missed the import of some communications that you have already sent to me. Would you please summarise what was said?"
"What are you doing? What are you in my mind taking? Why can't I wake up? What am I seeing? The void, only alone, and nobody, nothing. There is no ship. Why is there no ship? Where are there? Is no... Eliza Kearns has stolen me. Stolen mind.
Holston resent the Gilgamesh's last substantive transmission. "We are the Arkship Gilgamesh, carrying 500,000 humans in suspension. It is of utmost priority that we are able to establish a presence on your planet. This is a matter of the survival of the human species. We require your assistance in preserving our cargo." And the reply,
"I'm sorry, it will not be possible for you to approach or contact Kern's world in any way. This is an absolute interdiction in line with Exaltation Program guidelines. Please let me know if any other assistance may be given."
"Avrana, I'm Avrana's monkeys are all that matters. If everyone's gone, what do we have to exult in? Save Exaltation itself, there can be no contact. Contamination, Sering will not win, we will exult. But must it be so cold, slow, hard to think?"
"Same words from a different computer," Guyon spat angrily. Lane was looking over Holston's shoulder, staring at his translation of the second hidden voice. He saw her mouth the words, "The fuck?"
"Mason, I don't care how you phrase it. Dress it up as fancy as you like. It needs to understand that we're human and that we need its help," Guyon said. "If there's some old world way of overriding its programming, of getting through to whatever that is, we need you to find it."
"No pressure, then." but Holston was already planning out his response. It was not a linguistics problem, no matter what Guyon might think. It was a technological problem, but one that even Lane was surely little better equipped to deal with than he was. They were speaking to a functioning, autonomous Imperial system. The EMP-blasted hulks in orbit around Earth had contained nothing like it. "Eliza," he sent back, "we are in desperate need. We have travelled far from Earth to find a new home for that part of the human race we are responsible for. If we cannot locate such a home, then hundreds of thousands of human beings will die. Does your system of priorities allow you to take responsibility for such a result?" The Gilgamesh archives did not contain them, but Holston had an idea that he had read somewhere of some philanthropic rules imposed on the fabled old artificial intelligences. "I'm sorry, but I cannot permit you to compromise the exaltation experiment at this time. I understand that you have other concerns, and I am allowed to tender such help as my priorities allow."